Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, we'll visit North Dakota's Gateway to Science. They make hands-on STEM learning more accessible than ever. In fact, they have scholarship opportunities to make sure their programs are affordable for everyone. And we'll talk with CEO Beth Demke about those programs. Plus, if you ever wanted to create your own internet radio station, we'll have everything you need to know coming up in Tech with Peck. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public, and in just a moment, we'll visit with North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer. The topic, North Dakota voters will decide a constitutional measure in the June 9th primary election that could change how future constitutional amendments are written and presented to voters. But first, the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota has been one of the state's most important research institutions for decades, helping advance energy technology while supporting hundreds of jobs and attracting millions of dollars in research funding. Last month, uncertainty surrounded federal grants and led to the EERC, led them to furlough employees and reduce staff. Now, some of those workers are returning, but questions remain about the center's long-term outlook and what the situation says about the future of research funding here in North Dakota. And joining us is Jeff Beach, deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor and author of the latest reporting on the EERC's workforce changes. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
You're welcome, Jeff. Glad that you're with us. For listeners, Jeff, who may not have followed this story from the beginning, what led to the furloughs and staffing reductions in the first place?
Well, the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center in Grand Forks, relies very heavily on federal grants, contracts with entities like the Department of Energy, primarily to do research projects that can take several months of work, sometimes longer. When the Trump administration kind of took over, they did a lot of examining of research contracts at all levels, really, not just from the Department of Energy, but agriculture, health and human services kinds of projects. And they put a pause on funding for a lot of projects while they kind of vetted them and made sure they were in alignment with the Trump administration policies and goals. The stream of money kind of turned into a trickle there for a while and kind of hamstrung the EERC, and eventually decided that they needed to cut some staff and furlough some of their staff also.
So bring us up to date, the latest developments. How many employees were furloughed? How many have returned to work? And what's made that possible?
They have brought back two workers from the furloughs. There could be more coming soon. They did cut 27 positions. There are 11 potential people who could come back that are on furlough now. So that's kind of the situation. They are hoping that they can bring people back as they get some new contracts with the Department of Energy finalized. The funding has been secured, but they still need to finalize the contracts, they say, before they can start to maybe bring a few more folks back to the EERC.
Is this an unusual situation for an institution like the EERC that has been really so important to the fabric, I guess, of the University of North Dakota?
Yeah, I think it is a pretty unusual situation, it's not unique to EERC, I don't think, as far as research goes under the current Trump administration. There have been a lot of research projects that got defunded. In agriculture, it was especially in the conservation side, some things got defunded, but like I said, health research, the dollars have kind of slowed down. The new projects that they are looking for partnership with entities like the EERC, those have slowed down somewhat too. So it's, you know, it is a kind of unique in recent history, but not unique to the EERC.
Do you have a feel, Jeff, for the types of projects and research areas that were most affected by this uncertainty of funding?
So I know one area that got cut was a late in the game. EERC still got its funding, but a carbon pipeline research project was cut through the Department of Transportation. So I think carbon storage and carbon capture programs might be in flux. You know, carbon capture for things like enhanced oil recovery are probably where you might see where carbon capture might still have a lot of funding. And that's actually one of the key areas that the Department of Energy announced recently that they want EERC to work on what Senator John Hoeven calls crack the code 2.0, trying to evolve, make some breakthroughs in enhanced oil recovery that could extend the life and make oil wells in Western North Dakota more productive.
What are leaders of EERC saying about the center's financial outlook for the rest of the year today?
Well, they're not saying a whole lot. You know, they are still, you know, dependent on working with the Trump administration. So I don't blame them for not being overly critical of the situation. You know, the Department of Energy had a representative at the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference last month. And, you know, they say that they have kind of vetted the research projects that they inherited from the Biden administration and that things are back on track so that at least existing projects, the funding should be back on. I don't know if there'll be the same level of research dollars available from the federal government going forward as there were in the past, however.
Are state lawmakers asking questions about this? Is there a role that the state could play or potentially play in assisting the EERC with its vision and with its goals?
Yes, the EERC also is the state energy research facility designated by North Dakota government and does get state funding for all kinds of different projects. In the last session, it was authorized to do some nuclear energy research. So the state will always probably providing some level of funding to the EERC. And they also have industry partners. You know, they get money from petroleum companies and from coal companies to work on specific projects and you know, or on things like carbon capture in the ethanol industry. So they are not solely reliant on the federal government for funding, but it is a big chunk of their budget.
Do we understand the broader economic implications if research funding remains unstable?
Well, I think I don't think the EERC is going to be, you know, building back up that staff beyond the furloughed workers anytime soon. I'm sure they'll, you know, Charlie Grecki, the executive director, I'm sure it was painful for him to have to cut back staff. I'm sure he's going to be budgeting very conservatively. You know, one thing about federal funding that some people don't realize is, you know, when funding is announced for a research project, it's not like the research entity gets the whole chunk of money up front. They usually have to show progress, file reports, you know, quarterly, and then money is released as you go along. So they did land some big federal contracts recently, but it doesn't mean that that money is in the bank for them.
How do you intend to continue to follow this story for us North Dakotans, Jeff?
We'll keep asking regularly where they're at on furloughed people, probably later on at the end of the summer, see how they're doing. You know, we'll be checking in on their Crack the Code 2.0. They do bring in, Senator Hoeven, especially is a champion of the EERC. And the work that they do for the coal and oil and gas industries, I'm sure he'll continue to work and hopefully bring us in for meetings every once in a while when they talk about some of their gee whiz technology.
Jeff Beach is the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor, and you can read his reporting on the EERC and other state policy issues at the North Dakota Monitor, northdakotamonitor.com. It's always free. It's always free from paywalls or subscriptions. Jeff, thanks again for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
And we now continue A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. North Dakota voters will decide on a constitutional measure next Tuesday in the June 9th primary election that could change how future constitutional amendments are written and presented to voters. Known as the Single Subject Amendment Measure, the proposal would require constitutional amendments to focus on a single issue rather than combining multiple policy changes into one proposal. Supporters say that would make measures clearer and easier for voters to evaluate. Critics argue that it could create new hurdles for citizen-led initiatives and invite legal challenges. To help us better understand what's at stake, we're joined by North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer. Mary, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hello.
What exactly, Mary, will voters be asked to decide on June 9th?
Well, it's like you said, the proposal is to make all constitutional amendment proposals on the ballot limited to a single subject.
And what problem is the measure intended to address? How did this surface into something that needed to be presented and voted on in this way?
So it was referred to the ballot by lawmakers and supporters in the legislature, basically said the purpose of the resolution is to make constitutional amendments easier to the for the public to understand when they're voting on them, and also more straightforward.
Is single subject ambiguous? What does it mean in practical terms?
I think some opponents of the proposal would argue that it could be ambiguous. I think the idea is to make all ballot measures about one thing rather than being about multiple things rolled into one. And legislation passed by lawmakers already has this requirement.
Who brought this forward to become a ballot measure, and what were their arguments that they were making other than, of course, the single question argument? What really were the other concerns?
So the group of lawmakers who sort of championed it say that, you know, this will simplify amendments for voters. And, you know, they said it would prevent scenarios, hopefully, where something only gets passed, maybe because it's buried in a long list of other items. I talked to Senate Majority Leader David Hogue, and I kind of asked, like, was there one specific measure you had seen that had raised concerns to you? And I don't recall him pointing to any one particular thing, but he just kind of said moving forward, you know, he thinks this is a good idea.
It sounds so simple to me. Are there concerns that have been raised by opponents to this question?
Yeah, opponents have said they're worried that this would add another hurdle to especially voter-initiated measures being passed.
And in an indirect way, Mary, is it trying to make that harder for some reason, or is it just not about that?
I guess you could say it's trying to make it harder in that they want to exclude things that are, you know, a bunch of different proposals tacked into one. Like supporters want to exclude what they would deem like hard to understand proposals, but they definitely say the purpose is not to make it harder to pass amendments in general. Like they don't advertise it as a way to curtail the voice of citizens. So they say it's not about that, but then opponents are concerned that that'll be the impact. And then they also have said, you know, they're worried about how the definition of single subject could be interpreted. Like, they worry that, right?
Who decides that question? Yeah.
So the language of the proposal makes it the Secretary of State, but Secretary Howe, in testimony to the legislature, has said he would rely on the Attorney General's office to help his office make those determinations. So I think supporters of the measure point to that and say, you know, like, this will be, we'll have officials who know what they're doing interpret this, but then opponents will say, well, you know, they're worried that
they don't like it, they'll find something wrong with it.
Right. Or if anyone is determined to find something wrong with a measure, they could potentially, you know, push to interpret single subject broadly or narrowly.
So this would also apply to constitutional amendments referred by the legislature. It's not just for citizen-led constitutional amendments.
Right. And one question I had, and I don't think I have got it answered at this point. I hope I'm not just forgetting, but I wondered, because laws passed by the legislature already have the single subject requirement, if that already applies to resolutions passed by the legislature that refer something to the ballot. I don't know, but in this case, it'd be, you know, anything referred to the ballot would have to pass this test before the Secretary of State's office could certify it to go on the ballot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my perception, Mary, that this issue really hasn't grabbed the public. There hasn't been much attention paid to this, yet it'll be on the ballot next Tuesday on June 9th when we vote in the primaries. Is that your perception too?
That's certainly my perception as well. Yeah, I haven't heard, you know, I went around asking people about it, but I haven't organically run into conversations, people like discussing this.
I've seen no yard signs for or against this proposed constitutional amendment. Mary Stoyer covers politics, elections, and public policy for the North Dakota Monitor. You can read her reporting and the reporting of her colleagues at the North Dakota Monitor website, northdakotamonitor.com. Of course, all of what's written for the North Dakota Monitor is free from subscriptions, free from paywalls, and is excellent reporting on state government issues. Mary, thanks for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thank you very much.
And just a quick programming update, A Closer Look with the Monitor. We'll have a brief respite next week, but we'll be back with you on June 18th.
Dakota Pro Musica concludes its sixth season with performances of Esther, the Beautiful Queen by William Bradbury, a choral work first performed in 1856 and widely sung in America through the early 20th century, June 12th in Richardton, June 13th in Valley City, and June 14th in Bismarck. Information at dakotapromusica.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and North Dakota's gateway to science is open and running strong here as summer is upon us. Of course, it's on the banks of the Missouri River, just off I-94 in Bismarck, and at the center of that effort is CEO Beth Demke. She joins us again on Main Street to talk about all things North Dakota gateway to science. Beth, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Tell me about the David and Delaine Popke Scholarship Fund. What's it for?
Well, it's really meant to allow students that might have an economic disadvantage to be able to participate in summer camps, after school clubs, really any program that we offer that would require a registration fee. David Popke was one of our exhibit developers early on. I mean, if you come in, you'll see some of the things that he made for us, but he would imagine some really fun things and then just go off and build them. He was a welder by trade and was able to just build some really fun things for kids. But he had a friend, Bert Riskadal, and Bert and Margot wanted to put a scholarship fund together in Dave's name. So Dave and Delaine, and it has built up so that we're able to offer these scholarships for kids. The application is very simple. It's online. It just asks for a reference that can attest to the need, and then we will help those students get involved in our camps or clubs or any of those programs.
Even just coming to Gateway to Science, perhaps for folks that can't afford that?
We have a different program for that, actually, and that one is called Museums for All. Museums for All is a nationwide program, and we allow anyone that's carrying a SNAP, EBT card, or that type of evidence can come in and either get daily admission at $3 a person or buy an annual membership for $35. So there's lots of ways that we make sure that North Dakota's Gateway to Science gallery and other services are accessible to as many as possible. This should not be an exclusive club. This is for all.
Mentioned at the top, summer's in full swing now. What are your hours? How can people access?
Well, we are now open 7 days a week. So on Sundays, we're open from 1 to 5. On Mondays and Tuesdays, we're open from 10 to 5. Wednesdays from 9 to 5. Thursdays from 10 to 7 p.m. That's our late evening. Friday from 10 to 5. And then Saturday, we close a little early. So we're open from 9 until 3 o'clock.
Now, July 4th already isn't too far away. What are your hours around the 4th of July?
We will be open our regular hours every day except that Saturday. So on the 4th of July, we will be closed. We want to make sure our families have a chance to celebrate with their families.
She's Beth Demke. She's the CEO of North Dakota's Gateway to Science. She oversees the organization's strategic direction, partnerships, and long-term growth, all while helping advance the mission of providing hands-on STEM learning opportunities throughout the state of North Dakota and beyond. Beth, thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
Have you been fighting the weeds yet this spring? Whether it's in gardens, yards, or fields, the weeds seem to be a perpetual problem. These weeds, particularly the non-native and noxious weeds, seem to be constantly cussed and discussed. But we often give little thought to the native weedy species. My Webster's New World Dictionary defines a weed as, quote, any undesirable, uncultivated plant, especially one growing in profusion so as to crowd out a desired crop, disfigures a lawn, etc., unquote. Another commonly used definition for a weed is a plant out of place, or perhaps a plant that does not have human utility. Either way, we often think of weeds as non-native plants. Some will use the term exotic, that have been deliberately or inadvertently introduced and have become invasive or in other ways problematic. We seldom, however, give any consideration to the native weedy plants. Consider for a moment a fast-growing native plant that has a short lifespan, maybe an annual or short-lived perennial, that produces lots of small seeds that get widely dispersed. That's descriptive of weedy species. These weedy plants have the ability to quickly colonize disturbed areas, which may be unstable and/or unpredictable. As such, these weedy plants are well adapted and thrive in disturbed areas. So they are the plants we often see on disturbed areas, ranging from blowouts in the sandhills, old gopher mounds, around abandoned fox or badger dens, or following grassland or forest fires, etc. As the old saying goes, nature abhors a vacuum. So weedy natives to the rescue. These weedy species are important components of early successional stage plant communities. Because they're quick to colonize the area, they help stabilize the soil and reduce erosion. Their vegetative growth will provide food and cover for animals, flowers for pollinators, and seeds for a wide range of seed-eating birds, small mammals, and others. Over a few seasons of growth, these plants will enrich the soil with their organic matter and also increase nutrient cycling before yielding to other plant communities. So the next time you see a few hardy plants occupying some of these disturbed areas on the grasslands or wooded areas, give some thought to the important ecological functions these weedy natives are providing. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still ahead on this Thursday's Main Street Tech with Peck. You ever thought about starting your own internet radio station? You already likely have all that you need. That's ahead on today's Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For decades, starting a radio station, kind of like Prairie Public, meant buying a transmitter, securing a license, investing a small fortune. Today, though, anyone with a computer, a microphone, and an internet connection can launch a station heard around the world. But how difficult is it really? What equipment do you need? And what about music licensing? How do you stream it? How do you attract listeners? Joining us once again is our technology expert, George Peck. He's created the internet radio station, The Other Side, otherside.live. And we are going to talk then about the nuts and bolts of creating an internet radio station. George, welcome back to Tech with Peck.
We're on that expensive radio transmitter with the FCC license that required. And
now we are.
And we also stream, so you can hear it after it has been broadcast throughout the airwaves on the internet. So we're kind of covering both the bases.
And the board that you are sitting in front of, I'll bet you, is simultaneously operating a radio station via the internet. Am I right about that?
So it could be, but I actually have a direct connection between my music playout system and my encoder. We'll talk about the encoder. So the audio console does not actually have to be in the loop. It can be. If I decide I want to go live, I flip a switch. The audio console goes to the encoder, but I can actually be on here doing an internet interview, a podcast, and no one listening to OtherSide.live is the wiser.
George, define for us, what is an internet radio station? What does that mean?
So that's a good question, and I think it's a good thing to kind of compare it and contrast it to a podcast, because a podcast, I think it's fascinating. Podcast. Everyone has podcasts. How long ago was it there were radio talk shows? Well, podcast is a talk show that's not on the radio. It's just an audio file played back over the internet. So a podcast has been pre-recorded. It's an audio file that you can simply play back and listen to whenever you want. An internet radio station is really a real-time, in most cases, should be 24/7, broadcast without the transmitter. So as opposed to a podcast that you can listen to whenever you want, and it's the same thing that somebody else would hear this morning at 8 o'clock, and someone else would listen to the podcast tonight at 7, and someone would listen to the podcast tomorrow. When you tune into an internet station, it's real time, and whatever is being streamed at that time is what you hear. So it's really real-time radio without the transmitter.
Why did you start your radio station?
I started my internet station about 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago in 2020. Lots of strange things were going on in 2020, and I decided to finally do the internet station. I had volunteered for a radio station in Denver, and we got a whole nother topic for another day. KUVO, it's one of the few stations in the country that plays jazz 24 hours a day. But we can talk at some point about HD radio, which I think Prairie Public broadcasts on.
Yes, we do.
And there are HD sub-channels, and I had the opportunity to program the HD3 channel on KUVO. So I did The Other Side actually as a radio station format for a long time before that. Yeah. But the online version of The Other Side started in June of 2020.
So how do you license the music that you bring to us?
Yeah, so that is the big question. If you are, first of all, if you're not a music online station, if you are talk or something other than music, it's not such a problem. But if you play music, so right now, right now on my station is the brand new Rolling Stones.
Nice.
So it's a brand new album called Foreign Tongues that's coming out later in the year. So that's on right now. I need to pay to play that song. So there are licensing agencies like Sound Exchange. Sound Exchange is an organization that collects royalties and pays artists. There is BMI, Broadcast Music Incorporated. Radio stations are dealing with that as well. There's ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. There's other Canadian, if you are online in Canada, you need a licensing agency to take care of your Canada listeners. If you are in the UK, and by the way, my streaming provider just turned me off in the UK because I didn't elect to pay for the new streaming requirement there. So every country, and in some countries, more than one organization licenses the ability to play music. So you have one of two ways or three ways of doing it. You can, like many internet stations, just not do it and hope you don't get caught. You can enter into an agreement with each of them individually, which I looked to do. Or you can find an organization that will license for you as part of your streaming service. And that's what I use. It's a company called Live365. And the thing I like about Live365 is not only do they carry my stream for me and stream the music, but they keep track of the songs I play, and they pay my royalty requirements to Sound Exchange, BMI, ASCAP, whatever the Canadian licensing arm is. And up until day before yesterday, they took care of my UK licensing. Now that's extra. But that is how I do it. That's the best way. But some organizations go through it individually. As an aside, public radio stations, public music stations are facing having to deal with that themselves up until federal funding was eliminated. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, like Live 365, took care of licensing for public radio stations. Public radio stations, like internet stations, now are on their own.
We are indeed. George, what's the minimum equipment I might need to get on the air, assuming that I have prearranged now a licensing system so that I can do this legally?
So a personal computer, that's it.
With a microphone, maybe not.
Well, if you want to record your voice, if you don't want to record your voice, you just want to play music back, or you've got other programming, you don't even need the microphone. But you need a computer that performs two basic tasks. It encodes the internet stream, and then it feeds the encoder audio. Now, you don't even have to have that. Live 365, for example, and there are other services that do this, has a cloud-based system where all you do is either upload music or purchase music. You then store the music on the Live 365 servers. You generate a playlist on the cloud system, and you play back that playlist, and you don't have to have anything running in your home or office at all. It's all done in the cloud. I chose to do it myself in my home on my own machine because that gives me good control. I can fade between songs. If I decide I want to go live, I flip a switch and I can now go on the air live, online, live. So that's the way I chose to do it. It depends on what you want. But at minimum, a computer, and that computer runs some kind of a programming system to play back audio. And then you have an encoder that converts that audio into the internet stream. That then encoder is sending its stream to a streaming server that then broadcasts on the internet to listeners.
Visiting with George Peck, we do so every Thursday. The segment is called Tech with Peck. We're talking about internet radio stations today. George, I was always very interested in a device that I never bought, and that was a desktop radio-like looking device that was designed to play internet radio stations, and I always thought I should buy one. I never did. Of course, I can use now my phone, my laptop, my desktop to stream anything that I would like. How should people take advantage of what you offer?
Well, there's a whole lot of ways, and you can, at bare minimum, have a computer or a tablet or your phone. As long as it's connected to the internet, you can go to the website and just listen through there. But many people listen through apps. So TuneIn is an app, probably the most popular app for internet radio stations and podcasts. And then if you would like to design your own app, that is done. And you can download many radio station apps from the App Store and listen that way. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to do it. In my car, many people will just Bluetooth their phone. So you're listening to the station through whatever app you have, tune in off a web browser, and then you Bluetooth it into your car. My Tesla has the tune in app built in, so I can just launch the tune in app on my Tesla screen and listen to any tune in station in the car. So apps are very popular. Listening off the website is popular. So it's kind of half of one, half of the other.
How do you know who's listening?
So I have two different approaches. So Live 365 keeps what I would say is a moderate amount of metadata or data on my listeners. A traditional streaming server writes logs. And every time a new listener comes online and listens to the station, the streaming server writes a record to a log. And it writes the time the stream started. It writes the internet protocol, the IP address of the listener. It writes the browser or the client they're listening to. So they're listening with the TuneIn app. They're listening with Apple Music. They're listening with, a Chrome browser. and it writes these items to a log, and then you can extract the logs and do analysis on how many people listened, when they were listening, how long they listened, and then using their IP address, you can find out where they were listening from. So I get that information either from a streaming server that I run directly or from Live 365.
How do you allow people to discover your internet radio station?
I'm chuckling because that's the least capable part of my internet radio. I haven't been super good at promoting it. So, social media, I think probably as with almost anything now, social media would be the first answer. Above and beyond what we would have discussed a few years ago and what we discussed on, I think, a show a couple of weeks ago, which would have been internet search. So I think social media probably is the primary method of promoting it.
You have a website?
Yeah, I've got a website. Still, again, probably some internet search is good. I just haven't made a lot of effort to promote. And the format for my particular station is very eclectic. So if I look at my playlist right now, I'm playing a Teskey Brothers song. That's a band out of Australia, Blues Brothers. I'm going to follow that with a Dolly Parton, followed by a Father John Misty, followed by an ASAP Rocky, followed by Chase, a band that had one hit in the 70s, a brass band led by a trumpeter, followed by Teddy Swims, followed by Cherry Poppin' Daddies. This is not going to be gathering huge numbers of listeners who want to hear classic rock or classic hits.
George, is it fair to say that you did this because of your love for music?
I love music. I love music and I love radio. And the combination of both of those things, it was my career for 10 years, and then it's been my hobby for the past 40. And so it was a way of just kind of combining those two loves together. And the idea of my online station is to really go beyond mainstream hits, not the top 40, not the classic rock or the classic hits. So it's not a broad reach mainstream offering. And so it doesn't get big listenership.
I remember you struggled initially with the quality of music you were presenting to us that we could hear, and I assume that meant a codec thought or a discussion or debate in your mind about how you actually then presented them to us, whether it's really low fidelity or higher fidelity. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, so that's a great question. And I am a serious, some would say over-obsessed audiophile. And I listen so carefully to the quality of audio and music. And Napster was the first kind of internet music approach, and it used low quality MP3 files, and they sounded terrible. And in the early days of internet streaming, we were streaming on modems, on 2400 baud modems, or, before we started to get things like DSL lines. So you had low bandwidth, and in order to be able to listen to music on low bandwidth, it had to be very, 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 very heavily compressed, which just compromised audio quality. So MP3, we talk about, not everyone, but probably almost everyone knows what an MP3 file is. That's where it all started. But MP3 streaming, in order to sound, I would say CD quality would be the goal that I would have. CD quality, that's now an old school term.
It is.
But really good, high quality audio. It just didn't happen with an MP3 file. So as bandwidth has increased, as internet has gone to dedicated DSL or cable, or in my case, fiber internet, we now have bandwidth, cellular is high speed in many cases. You can listen to very high quality audio. Sure. So I have now transitioned to something called AAC from MP3. AAC is just a next level of encoding that can about double the quality in the bandwidth. So if you had 128K of MP3, which was kind of the standard maybe 15 or 20 years ago, and you go to 128K AAC, you are going to experience much improved audio quality. And now it's very easy to do 320K or 520K streaming. And most people would probably be able to listen to that because they have high bandwidth. So quality now is much easier to attain. So now the encoder becomes very important because you've got open source encoders. My favorite's BUTT, B-U-T-T, broadcast using this tool is what it stands for. And it, you know, free is okay, but I have listened to stations encoding with BUT and they sound terrible. Even though you're listening at 128K AAC, one encoder can do a very, very good job of actually encoding as good as it possibly can, and others don't, even at the same bandwidth. So I listened very carefully to the output of encoders and elected to actually pay for one for my Apple called Audio Hijack. And Audio Hijack not only was the most pristine encoder I listened to, but it's incredibly flexible. So if you want the best quality, you probably have to pay a little bit for it.
Lastly, George, what do you see the trends here with internet radio versus the explosive popularity of podcasts?
Podcasts, it's interesting. I think that internet radio certainly has a future, but I think it's depending on what the programming is. If you want to listen to music and there's a particular type of music you want to listen to, are you going to listen to an internet radio station or are you going to listen to Spotify? Or are you going to go to Pandora? Or are you going to go to, you know, a service like that that is an on-demand music service? So podcasts aren't necessarily what I consider to be something that I need to pay more attention to as I would pay attention to Spotify or
Pandora. Let me tell you why I asked that question. And you talked about being able to use TuneIn on your Tesla. To listen to FM radio on my EV, FM radio is almost buried amongst many other apps. It's not presented like it used to be right there in our dashboard. It was the only game in town. We've got all of these other things that are in our face to choose for our in-car entertainment.
And if you think that's bad, try being an AM radio station manager.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
My Tesla doesn't even have an AM radio in it. And as an interesting aside, there is legislation before Congress to require car manufacturers to include AM radios in cars going forward. I don't know where that's going to go. But yeah, radio is obviously being challenged by internet and has been for years and years. In my case, if folks want to not have the benefit of my internet station is you don't know what you're going to hear next. If you want to know what
not
you're going
top 40,
to hear,
right?
You've not top 40. Although I did add a Miley Cyrus song last week, but it's probably not something you're going to hear on a top 40 station. But in any event, if you want to hear something very different and unpredictable, a real-time internet radio station is still that kind of an option, as opposed to a Spotify or a Pandora. It just depends on what you're looking for.
So whether you're interested in music, talk, programming, local community network perhaps, or simply sharing a passion with the world, of course you can do it with an internet radio station. Our thanks to our tech expert, George Peck, for joining us with Tech with Peck. I'm looking forward, George, to seeing you in person here in a week or so. We will not have Tech with Peck next Thursday, but we'll be back with a Tech with Peck that George and I are going to record together when we visit Fort
in person. Amazing. Like in the old, like an old radio talk show, Craig. It'd be fun. George, looking forward to it, man.
Thanks for joining us, George.
See ya.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. The American Kestrel. Small, numerous, and widespread. Watch for one of these North American falcons perched on a utility wire, bobbing its tail. True to the name falcon, this species is built for speed, with long, pointed wings, often bent back at the tip. If a suitable perch isn't available, American kestrels will hover above an open field. Facing into the wind, they flap their wings and use their tails to hold their position. From aloft, kestrels watch for insects, small mammals, and reptiles, which they overtake and capture. Don't be fooled by their small size, equal to that of a robin. These are fierce hunters. Using their notched beaks, kestrels quickly subdue their prey by severing the spinal cord at the neck. The lack of suitable nesting cavities limits kestrel populations in some areas, and this has led people to install wooden nest boxes. Many states now have Kestrel Nest Box programs, placing boxes along interstate highways. On I-35 in Iowa, there's a Kestrel box nearly every mile from Minnesota to Missouri. The Kestrels readily adapt to these boxes and return each spring to set up housekeeping. You can find out more about Kestrels, including photos and plans for a nest box, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 4th. It took many years for Theodore Roosevelt National Park to become a reality. When Theodore Roosevelt died in 1919, proposals were immediately put forward to create a national monument in his honor. Inspired by Roosevelt's love of nature and his efforts to protect the environment, ideas naturally centered on a new national park or wildlife refuge. Roosevelt developed a great fondness for North Dakota during his time in the state. As he later wrote, it was still the Wild West in those days, the Far West, the West of Owen Wister's stories and Frederick Remington's drawings, the West of the Indian and the buffalo hunter, the soldier and the cowpuncher. North Dakota seemed like a logical location for a living monument in Roosevelt's honor. A committee chose Medora. In 1921, the North Dakota legislature authorized representatives in Congress to assist by setting aside land for a park. In 1925, Major E.A. Goldman led a survey to determine the suitability of the Badlands as a site. He concluded that the area includes much scenic charm and scientific interest. Although ranchers opposed a plan that would put grazing land off limits, Goldman believed the park would provide an economic benefit by attracting tourists who would spend money in the area. During the drought and crop failures of the Dirty 30s, the federal government was able to buy cheap land as farmers sold out. The Roosevelt Regional Park Project was approved in 1934, and the Civilian Conservation Corps immediately began building roads, campgrounds, and trails. That work halted in 1941 with the outbreak of World War II. In 1946, the area was designated the Theodore Roosevelt National Wildlife Refuge. On April 25, 1947, President Truman signed the bill naming it Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park. The park was officially dedicated on this date in 1949. That wasn't the end of the story. On November 10, 1978, President Carter signed a law changing the name to Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Today, the park receives about 600,000 visitors each year, with the busiest months being in June, July, and August. The park continues to memorialize President Roosevelt and honor his dedication to conservation and the environment. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Senators try to use an immigration spending bill that President Trump wants to block spending Trump also wanted. Many lawmakers would like to prevent the president from reviving an agreement with himself to send taxpayer dollars to people he says are wronged by the government. So what's the solution? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That wraps up this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we will look forward to seeing you again Monday right back here on Main Street.